if you look at how I view the Who's job, the Who's function, as, hey, we're a bunch of guys, we come from the Shepherd's Bush area of London, we've been lucky, we've got a record deal, we've written a song, we've been on the TV. Hey, this week we get laid, next week we go back to working in the garage.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man behind blue eyes.
Behind Blue Eyes is a strange song. It's not a ballad, it's about vengeance. Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for Who's Next.
Few rock fans realize that immediately prior to the album Tommy's 1969 release, the British quartet The Who were on the brink of breaking up. They were hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and yet to score a top 10 hit in America. The album Tommy changed all that for The Who, and they spent the remainder of 1969 and most of 1970 touring the world while critics lauded composer Pete Townsend as a genius. As 1970 waned, Townsend found himself, no doubt, encouraged by the universal acclaim he received for his rock opera Tommy. Pete Townsend decided to do home demos for another audio-visual high-concept piece in late 1970.
Tommy was incredibly difficult to follow. You know, it was huge. It kind of existed outside of The Who. It challenged The Who. It challenged what we were. It changed us, but didn't tell us what to do next. And although it kind of got us out of the hole, you know, prior to which we'd been a, you know, a singles band that wore funny clothes and smashed their equipment, it left us with another big job, you know, which was what do we do next? So I was working on a very, very ambitious piece at the time, for the time, called Lifehouse, which was going to be a movie based on a live performance of The Who that was projected to last 5 to 6 days in a theatre called The Young Vic in London. And through that live performance were going to be spun a series of fictional stories, you know, that wove their way in and out of the concert. And the concert itself was also a part of the story. And off we marched into the land of mixing Hollywood filmmaking, concert footage filmmaking with science fiction and Sufism and all kinds of other stuff. It was a very, very big project for me, much bigger than I could handle, but I had a lot of fun working on it. And the band were right behind me. They had absolute faith in me because of my success with Tommy, I suppose. About halfway through the project, I realized that, you know, that our managers were on hard drugs, and they weren't exactly undermining the project aggressively, but there was a problem. It was that Kit Lambert was representing to Ned Tennant that I was crazy, and that that what we really wanted to do was to make a movie of Tommy. This is before Ken Russell's film, and that Lifehouse was in fact Tommy. And of course, it wasn't me that was crazy, it was Kit Lambert. But it did undermine the project. And for a while there, I did think I was crazy. I did go a bit nuts, I think. I'd recorded the whole thing once at home, very, very carefully. My demos from that period are exemplary. The Who had recorded it again in rehearsal at the Young Vic. We had then come to New York, and with Felix Pappalardi and Leslie West, we'd done a couple of recordings at the New Record Plant of some of the songs from Lifehouse, including a wonderful version of Behind Blue Eyes, a great version of Won't Get Forward Again with Leslie West jamming away in the background. And then we'd realized that Kit Lambert, who was our producer at the time, was just seriously strung out on heroin. And we abandoned the session and came back to London and went into the studio, really with me emotionally, mentally, physically and spiritually collapsing.
I gotta lose me to find you. I gotta give up all I have. To find you, I'd suffer anything and be glad. I'll pay any price just to get you. I work on my life and I will. Stone and stab.
Bargain on Who's Next is an economics lesson on the cost-benefit ratio of the value of spiritual true love. Bargain shows off Roger Daltrey on lead vocals, composer Pete Townsend on vocal interludes, all guitars and synthesizers, the late John Entwistle on rippling bass, and the seemingly four-armed, three-legged Keith Moon, also deceased, on drums. Over the years, it's remarkable how prescient Pete Townsend was in predicting the future with Lifehouse.
You know, and since that day, a lot of things that seemed crazy at the time are now common parlance. You know, the whole idea of virtual reality, grid life, as I called it in those days. You know, William Gibson, his cyberpunk books has introduced the idea of, you know, living on the internet and or the cybernet or the matrix or jacking in, jacking out, whatever. And we have a received and accepted notion of virtual reality as something which is going to be part of human entertainment and experience, not just a way for, you know, U.S. pilots pilots to learn how to fly jets. So a lot of those things have actually happened now. So it would be a good thing to look back on, but it's very, very complicated. It was too big for me to deliver. You know, I was just a guitar player and I wrote rock songs, and I didn't know what the hell I was getting into. And it was huge, absolutely huge. You know, I met Karlheinz Stockhausen. I was working with, you know, the composer in residence at Cambridge University. I was working with computer manufacturers. I had the first big guitar interface studio synthesizer in the world. I was doing all this stuff all at once, all in 1 week. I was learning about the way that, the great Sufis had laced the spiritual life into quantum physics. I was just out of my depth.
Next, widely regarded as one of rock's greatest efforts, you'd probably be surprised to find some less than glowing comments about it by band members in The Who around the time it was released, including an August 1972 Sounds magazine interview with Townsend himself. But now Pete wonders if he was just mentally and physically exhausted at the time.
I wasn't disappointed. I was, you know, I think I got on my knees and thanked God that we had anything at all. I don't think Keith and John were as crazy about the sound that Glyn Johns produced for us as perhaps I was. I've always loved his kind of open-faced, open-canvas work. He gave us space and breadth in our work that wasn't there before. And I think my work as a producer on Quadrophenia is an example of The Who in close-up, The Who, you're riding on the locomotive. What Glyn did was actually stood away from the band, and the band still had tremendous strength and dynamic. And I love the album. I still love it. I think it's a classic record. It's a great record, and I think it was brilliantly produced. And I think everybody in the band will concede that ultimately. But I think at the time, maybe you're right. Maybe there was a sense that we'd shot for not just a great movie or a great idea, but we were hoping for a truly great earth-shaking record. And what we got was a great record. It didn't shake any earth, but.
Going Mobile features a lead vocal not by The Who's powerful lead singer Roger Daltrey, but rather by the song's composer, Pete Townsend, who was encouraged to sing it by Who's next producer, Glyn Johns.
Well, I think that song was just, Glyn just suggested that I sit and sing it live, and I did it, and it worked. I think it was Glyn that suggested that I sang that. I certainly never anticipated ever singing with The Who. I sang with The Who when I had to. You know, I'd deliver a song and Roger would say, not going to sing it. You sing it. And his choices would often surprise me. You know, I would think he's not going to sing this because this is too personal, or he's not going to sing this because this is about men wearing dresses, or it would always surprise me. It would often just be because of something about the song where that he couldn't maybe capture the ebullience that was in it or something. I don't know, anyway. Well, you know, I have actually developed a voice since. You know, I mean, I think since I began my solo career with Empty Glass, I've actually developed quite a voice, and I'm very proud of it. But in those days, I'd never bothered to learn to sing. I just used to kind of, I'm the gypsy, the acid queen. You know, I used to squeak away into my tape recorder, and Roger's voice was just huge. I never ever attempted to emulate it.
It's the composer of the world's first rock opera and the destroyer of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of guitars, who also revolutionized the synthesizer in rock music. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with The Who's Pete Townsend for the anniversary of Who's Next.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend, in the studio for Who's Next.
And I'm Redbeard for the anniversary of this all-time classic, ranked number 28 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 list of all time. The lead-off song on Who's Next, better known by its refrain, Teenage Wasteland, has the actual title of Baba O'Reilly. The song's composer, Pete Townsend, tells the story of the odd title.
For the the Lifehouse Duct, a series of electronic music experiments which involved trying to use statistical information about people to make random music. And, you know, in this day and age, you can go out and you can buy a $50 computer program to do the job. You know, you put your height and your weight, your astrological details, the color of your skin, your length of your hair, and away you go, and you get a piece of music out of the back. In those days, it was a pretty tough prospect. But I thought I'd start with an experiment based on the statistics of my Indian master at the time, Meher Baba. When I'd finished, I was amazed to hear that the end result sounded very much like a piece by a guy called Terry Riley, who I was very into at the time. And so I called it Barbara O'Reilly. That was it, really.
The opening sounds of Baba O'Reilly, the rippling, repetitive cascades of hypnotic melody that danced before your ears, it was something previously unheard by human ears.
Well, it was a mixture of devices. It was using organs, which were getting pretty fancy then, and synthesizers together, and trying to find ways to synchronize the clocks together, recording random sections of stuff onto tape, cutting tape up, re-recording bits of tape, cutting the tape up again, and getting rhythms from it. That was really what it was all about. I was very into, you know, I had a studio in my house, and, you know, I had an 8-track tape machine and a dozen quarter-inch machines and, you know, a basement full of weird speakers and echo units and chains and synthesizers and oscillators and all that kind of electronic music stuff. But what I was very good at was cutting tape. I mean, in those days, electronic music was about cutting tape, and I could do that, and I could do it fast. And Barbara O'Reilly has something like 2,000 or 3,000 edits in it. You know, the master tape goes by and it's all white. You know, it's just sticky plaster from start to finish. And what's very interesting is the stuff that I was cutting out, I was sticking together on a reel to keep it tidy, and that piece is a very interesting piece of music in its own right. But what I then did is I put a piano over the top, a guitar and a vocal, and made it sound a bit more like rock and roll.
Teenage wasteland, it's only teenage.
August 1971's album Who's Next, and featuring the little-known violinist Dave Arbus. That's Baba O'Reilly by The Who. The dynamics evident there are what the English refer to as light and shade, and there's an even better example on Who's Next in the case of the song Behind Blue Eyes.
Yeah, I think that's all there in the composition. I think that, you know, that what The Who did was add tremendous edge to it. And, you know, this is something that's worth talking about, really, is that all the way down the line, you know, the thing that I anticipated whenever I wrote a song was is that if there was a hint of edge, if there was a hint of power on the demo, the band would take that and amplify it 1,000-fold. Behind Blue Eyes is a perfect example of the fact that The Who were a very, very dynamic group. You know, we had very, very high highs and low lows. Very, very much something that I think Led Zeppelin developed into their own, obviously, very private tradition. But you know that, something that I think that people have always enjoyed in their work. That you know that they could go from being very, very, very heavy to very, very delicate and acoustic, you know, on the same song, on the same album. That kind of dynamic really runs a lot through my work, either music starting kind of in one form and going to another, or music passing through a reflective phase and then going back to its original place. It's been a kind of, I don't know that I've done it until I finished the piece and I look back and I think, whoops, I've done it again. You know, I've actually written a song about, you know, I hate your guts and I want to kill you, and in the middle there's a bit that where it says, well, you know, maybe I don't really hate you, maybe I think you're okay, and maybe, you know, if we got together and went out for a drink we'd be pals, and then back to I hate your guts and I want to kill you. Behind Blue Eyes is a strange song. It's not a ballad, it's about vengeance.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man. Behind blue eyes, no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience. Love is vengeance that's never free. No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do, and I blame you. No one bites back as hard on their anger. None of my pain or woe can show through. But my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. Love is vengeance that's never free. When my fist clenches, crack it open before I use it and lose my cool. When I smile, tell me some bad news before I laugh and act like a fool. And if I swallow anything evil, put your finger down my throat. And if I shiver, please give me a blanket. Keep me warm, let me wear your coat. We'll be right back.
the sad man behind blue eyes.
A timeless song by The Who from Who's Next, that's Behind Blue Eyes. Next, Pete Townsend bars the door from those who would attempt to hijack The Who's musical legacy for political gain. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Pete Townsend for the anniversary of Who's Next.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for Who's Next.
And I'm Redbeard. At the time of the release of Who's Next, Pete Townsend was famous for two things: the composer of the rock opera Tommy, and the fiery, whirling dervish on stage, which concluded most live concerts by slamming his guitar into the stage until it shattered, spearing it through his amplifier cabinet, or in the case of the Woodstock Festival, clubbing it over the head of political activist Abbie Hoffman when he tried to address the crowd during the Who's set. I asked Pete Townsend the source of this apparent anger.
This is deep therapy. I have no idea. I have wonder what the truth is. You know, I mean, when I look back, I tend to have a sort of a fairly benign and analytical view. As I said earlier, I analyze and come to a conclusion about what happened. But I think it was probably not always real anger by any means. I think it was a way of it was performance art. I think my background was art school. You know, and very, very, very deconstructed art school at that. You know, I mean, it was a very extraordinary course that I was on, and it's produced the kind of course that I did. You know, post Bauhaus course actually produced a lot of you know, very radical thought in different areas of the arts. I mean, for me, I suppose it was about making sure that people looked at what I was doing and understood that there was anger driving from within, in a sense. That I didn't like members of the audience coming on the stage, but I certainly there was no kind of sense of territory between members of the band, I don't think. No, I did. There was a lot of anger, I think, in me, and I think that it was anger that drove a lot of my stage work, a lot of my writing, and in my intimate relationships, you know, in domestic relationships and things like that. You know, I think it's all the potential for it there has always been a problem for me. The fact that by appearing to be angry or looking like I might get angry, I can achieve things. I've never had to hit anybody to get what I want. I've never had to hit anybody to, or even hit back to win an argument. I can just look at somebody and shut them down. And I remember we were on the road in 89 and a Cleveland police chief told me that the way that policemen stay alive is by having what they call the look, you know, just before you draw the gun, I think. But what I'm saying is, I suppose I started to use it perhaps in a bad way. But I think on the stage, I think it was just very, very natural for me to express whatever it was that I was expressing in this melodramatic way, because I actually felt that everything that we did on the stage had to be large, had to be huge. It took a lot of energy. It took a lot of effort. You know, it wasn't so much anger, I don't think, as passion. I was very passionate about what I did. And there's a kind of I still have this don't f*** with me streak. You know, when I'm doing what I do, I don't want people kind of getting in the way and fiddling with it.
I'm singing this note because it fits in well with the chords I'm playing. I can't pretend there's any meaning hidden in the things I'm saying, but I'm in tune, right in tune. I'm in tune, and I'm gonna tune. When I look because it fits in well with the way I'm feeling. There's a symphony that I hear in your heart, sets my head reeling. But I'm in tune, right in tune. I'm in tune, and I'm gonna tune.
I remember my naive late 1960s sensibilities of hippie peace, love, and understanding, as Elvis Costello would later put it, being challenged by the worldly honesty of Pete Townsend's lyrics in Won't Get Fooled Again. At the time, in sharp contrast to the Woodstock hippie ethos that dominated youth culture in America back then, it seemed downright cynical.
I don't think it was cynical. I actually, if you look at how I view the Who's job, the Who's function, hey, we're a bunch of guys, we come from the Shepherd's Bush area of London, we've been lucky, we've got a record deal, we've written a song, we've been on the TV. Hey, this week we get laid, next week we go back to working in the garage. That was how things looked. What actually happened was is that the audience said to us, what you're doing is very, very important. You're going to have to go on doing it. That was a great honor, you know, to be commissioned by the audience to continue to express their work. I felt in a way, and I'm sure I speak for every member of the band in this respect, like I'd been elected from among their numbers and said, get up on the stage and don't come down until we tell you. We felt like we'd been elected to mayor, rather unwillingly perhaps, because we were hoping to have more fun than do this job. But it was a great job to get, you know, and as Roger often says, it was better than cutting up tin plate, you know, or whatever it was that he was doing in the factory that he worked in. And we already had a gig. And when, as a byproduct of the hippie era, the radical revolutionaries in this country, the Malcolm X's, Angela Davis's, the Chicago Six, the Chicago Seven, and the Chicago Eight, and in London, the proprietors of Oz magazine and International Times magazine came to the band and said, listen, you know, there is a revolution going on, and you should speak for that revolution. You know, you should be a part of it. You know, rock and roll has a job to do. My response was, hey, I've already got a job. Get out of my face. You know, I've already been elected. I'm driving this truck. Go elect somebody else. And these guys, on the whole, were people that were outside the music business looking in. I don't think they were all journalists by any means, but they were certainly political activists, and they didn't understand what rock music was for. They didn't understand that it was there to provide an outlet for expression, which may, in the end, have had a political and radical outcome. But certainly the music itself was not a part of that. You know, art is always something that stimulates and commentates. It's never something, you know, art doesn't do revolution. Art doesn't kill people. Art doesn't, you know, make a new political party. You know, and I think the problem was I was saying to them, listen, this is art, man. Get out of my face.
We'll be right back.
What's the difference to me? I don't care who's on the left or who's on the right. So there was a feeling of just trying to, you know, get it across to these dumb clerks that, you know, if they wanted to use rock and roll, they ought to find out what it was before they started to appropriate it. And that was really what it was about. You know, I don't feel that it was a new thought either. You know, I think a year before, maybe earlier than that, there'd been a record from Bob Dylan in which he'd sung, you know, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters. You know, I mean, look after your mode of transport in life, because you have a journey to travel. I think Dylan also said another extraordinary thing. He said, something is going on here and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And we made the album that you hear as Who's Next. And when Glyn Johns said, listen, I don't think it should be a double album, I think it should be a single, you know, I didn't have it in me to protest. When Ethan Russell, Glyn's friend, the godfather of his son, was suggested as the person to take the album cover, I didn't have it in me to protest. And when he suggested that we piss up against an edifice that he found in the middle of a slag heap, I didn't have it in me to protest. So I was kind of led by my nose into what has actually become probably the most important album of The Who's career outside of Tommy. So sometimes God has his ways of making you behave.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking the remarkable Pete Townsend. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcript Jane Carpenter, Brunei. Theme song by Annie Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net.